From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter. Made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available on iTunes.
Welcome to The Art of the Matter. I'm Sharon Gamble. On today's show, using Star Trek to get psyched about STEM education, a new outdoor attraction featuring more than a million lights, and books, booze, and brains. Don't try that at home. And don't forget, we'll have our arts calendar we call
What'll We Do?
All of that and much more right after the latest news from NPR. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and today we celebrate the change of seasons with light shows and music series. But first, while the Star-Spangled Banner is our country's official national anthem, it's America the Beautiful that resonates for many as a favorite tune about our nation's beauty and patriotism. The author of the poem that forms the lyrics is the subject of a new biography by Indianapolis native Melinda Ponder. The book is called Catherine Lee Bates, From Sea to Shining Sea, and I rang up Melinda to learn how she got interested in this subject. She began with a reading from the beginning of her book.
On the morning of November 11, 1918, bedraggled American soldiers on the hillsides near Verdun, France, grabbed their gas masks, helmets, and guns and stumbled forward in the fog. Their boots falling apart, their uniforms tattered, their few remaining horses emaciated, and their equipment broken down, they inched forward through minefield craters of thawing mud, crawling over skeletons of soldiers still entangled in shreds of old uniforms. With only shell-hole water to drink, they were freezing cold, hungry, and wet from 2 days of rain that had soaked even their bread. Worse, frozen mist enshrouding the stump-filled underbrush had socked in their air support. But as the mist dissolved, the soldiers heard the faint drone of Allied planes flying northward toward them. And then, a few minutes before 11 a.m., shouts of truce, truce, came from the rear lines. The armistice that the Germans signed that morning had finally stopped the fighting. On the battlefields, a bewildering silence fell. Like the 2 million other American soldiers in France, the Yankee division stood speechless, staring at one another. And then they began to sing.
What a chilling but uplifting scene. And I'm curious, was that what led you to wonder, where did this patriotic hymn come from?
No, although I was happy to have the archivist at Wellesley College give me this material once I was working on the book, I hadn't known about the scene before. I had first learned America the Beautiful when I went to School 86 right near Butler University.
Uh-huh.
And I'd always loved it, and then I'd sung it at Wellesley College where I went, and because that was where Catherine Lee Bates went to school. She was Katie of 80 in the class of 1880, and then taught on the faculty for her whole academic career. So I knew about America the Beautiful, but then I was curious about her when I was on a panel of people, Nathaniel Hawthorne scholars, who all singled out her introductions as the very best to a big edition of Nathaniel Hawthorne, and I thought, how could this be the same person who had written America the Beautiful? And since I knew about Nathaniel Hawthorne, I thought she did a wonderful job, especially writing about the women in his family and in his fiction. So I went out to Wellesley to see what I could find out there, and here were all her diaries and letters and scrapbooks of every single little tiny poem story, too, that she and her brother had pasted into scrapbooks and labels. So here was all her material. And then when I got working, starting really on the chronology of her life, I found that when she came back to Wellesley to be a teacher, she was surrounded by these young women in their 20s who were really wanting to help reform the country, excuse me, and get and really deal with the social issues, many of which I'm afraid we still have,
yeah, a century later.
Right. So I began learning about the history of her times, because even though she was a writer, and really she used her writing, I think, to engage with her times and to try to educate people about the social issues in her times, I still needed to learn the history.
Sure.
So that eventually took me to World War One, and one of the things I enjoyed doing part of my research for this book was that I visited most of the places that she had gone to see what she had seen, you know, because when you're working with written materials for your sources, although one day I did find her hair in one of these letters, you want to feel like you're sort of in touch with the person.
Sure.
So going to the places, especially her first trip out to Colorado, when she stopped at Chicago in 1893 at the famous World's Fair there, and saw the White City that I think found its way into her phrase about alabaster cities gleaming late in America the Beautiful. And then when I went out to Colorado and went up on the top of Pikes Peak, where she looked out at the Purple Mountains majesties, then I could picture sort of what she had seen, you know, even though it was 100 years before. So that helped me feel really kind of connected with her. And then I did follow her later to Spain and then to Egypt, too, where she really became a global citizen. And so even though she hadn't gone to Verdun herself, she did hear this story about the soldiers. And she said, the rest of the quotation is that they... tears came into their eyes as they sung her song, and that when she heard this about this episode, the tears came into her own eyes too. And so I did go to Verdun. I did want to see those hillsides, and of course when you're there you see these just, you know, lines of white crosses in the cemeteries.
Yeah.
Hundreds, thousands, stretching kind of to the horizon. So,
well, I did
really want to see where they had been standing.
Yeah, and all of that effort you went to pays off beautifully, because you really bring her to life. In fact, I had a funny experience reading the book, because I kept having to remind myself of, I kept as a reference flipping back to, now when was this woman born? Because she seems so fully realized and so very modern. She's a person at a crossroads of a new century. She's anti-war. She's we didn't have the phrase women's liberation then, but she would be a proponent. And she sees, from growing up in modest means, not least because of the death of her father early in her life, she sees education as the way out and the way to make the world egalitarian.
That's right. That's right. Well, she, you know, I think her mother, and she created a character in her fiction later that I think was very much like her mother. She described her, she said, whose generous heart made all the world her neighbor. And I think that was the ethos that Catherine grew up with in this little village of Falmouth on Cape Cod, where it was a maritime, of course, maritime trade was kept the village going. And so there were many women whose husbands had either died or were at sea, and then because she was born on the eve of the Civil War, many were widows there. And so they all helped each other out. And of course, you know, I tell about the scene that's so moving when Catherine was 5 and Abraham Lincoln had just been assassinated, and the village needed to come together in a memorial service in what had been her father's church when her father was alive. And they didn't have enough black fabric to drape the pews and the pulpit. And so the widows donated their shawls to be used. And Catherine wrote a poem later on that reminded her, told her readers, that she said that when she saw her mother's shawl was there, that was when she felt connected with the nation. And in fact, she didn't publish this poem until after World War One. And I think that it, I think that her experience of hearing about those soldiers singing her song, I think in a way it reminded her of her mother's participation earlier at this terrible crisis of Lincoln's death.
Melinda Bonder is the author of the new biography, Catherine Lee Bates, From Sea to Shining Sea. You can get the book anywhere books are sold and learn more about the author at melindaponder.com. So the most exciting thing you've heard recently is that Neil deGrasse Tyson is coming to Indianapolis. Well, listen up, because contributor Ben Schein checked out a new monthly book club for science lovers. It's sponsored by Indiana Humanities, and it's called Books, Booze, and Brains. Ben talked with Indiana Humanities Vice President Kristen Foose Wells.
Books, Booze, and Brains, possibly the coolest book club ever, pairing science with literature. Kristen? What's the concept? How did it all come together?
Yeah, so it's a book club for the scientifically curious, and like any great book club, it includes alcohol. And it's so we read popular science books, and it's free and open to the public, and we meet at the Broken Beaker Distillery. And you can come to one, or you can come to all of them. They're monthly. And we have a moderator named Carrie Lewis Sinovoy, and she was really passionate after the March for Science in April and wanted to keep that momentum going. And so the book club was her idea, her and Mel Fox from the Central Indiana Science Outreach, and they reached out to us, and we're the book people, so it's a great collaboration.
So this is part of a bigger series, right?
Yeah, so this is part of our Quantum Leap two-year initiative at Indiana Humanities, where we're focusing on bridging the STEM fields with the humanities. And we're doing a fleet of programs, including this book club, a big Frankenstein read in 2018, and all sorts of other fun field
Frankenstein
trips.
Read?
Yeah.
What does that mean?
We're doing a statewide read of the novel Frankenstein,
Awesome. Which
turns 200 in 2018.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it sounds like there are some real fun partners that are taking part in this series. Who are they, and how did you guys all come together?
Yeah, so it's the Central Indiana Science Outreach Group, and it's the March for Science from Indianapolis, and it's the Indiana State Museum. And Leah Namias and our team met with Mel and Carrie, and I think they just got really jazzed about the opportunity for a collaboration. We don't always get to play with science folks in the humanities and vice versa, so we just took off.
So this really is, like I said, the coolest idea for a book club. Who picks the books, and why do they pick the books they picked? I mean, you've had Oliver Sacks' Musicophilia, and coming up is The Burning Brain, which is about what happens when brains go haywire.
Yeah, so Carrie picks the book. She's picked this series, and we're taking suggestions for the next series. We'll have two more in this one. We'll have one in November and one in January. And Carrie picks really popular science books. She wants to pick books who are not necessarily written by the science experts. Sometimes they're a memoir, like this one coming up. Sometimes they're by journalists, and that really helps connect to the science people, but also the non-science people, too.
Yeah. Well, what makes a great science read? What does it take to present a science topic that's both interesting and captivating for someone who may not know anything about a topic or a non-science person?
Yeah, well, we're really lucky right now. There are a lot of really great popular science books. And I think what makes it easier for the non-science folks is to have that journalistic approach or, again, to talk to people in the science fields, but not necessarily have the science person write the book so that we can all find it, kind of find our way along together.
Right. That's pretty awesome. Each event has a scientist or doctor that will be at each of the book clubs. And, you know, like the August event featured a book about cadavers, and you had a professor of anatomy and cell biology from
whose
the
name
School
was
of Medicine.
Dr. Organ. I'm not making that
perfect.
Up.
How did you guys pick the guests? Like, how did you find the right guests?
So, again, that's what's great about partnering with people like Mel and Carrie. They connect us to the scientists. When Carrie picks the book, she's also looking for great local people to talk about that book. So she matches the book with someone local who can give us insights into that. And that's where we pair it with a scientist.
So it wouldn't be books, booze, and brains without the booze, right?
That's right.
I'm really interested in the cocktail aspect of all of it.
Yeah.
Tell us more about the booze part of it.
So it's been a really fun partnership with Broken Beaker. They create a signature cocktail each month. One of my favorites was Four Stiff, the cadaver book. the cocktail was Pushing Daisies. So they have a lot of fun, I think, coming up with it. We have a lot of fun. Like I said, the event's free, but you can purchase the alcohol or non-alcoholic beverages when you come.
And they make a special drink for each night?
They do.
All right. What's the one for the burning brain?
No, I knew you were going to ask me. I don't know that answer, but I guarantee it will be delicious.
And maybe whiskey. So what's the crowd like? Is this mostly made up of people who are into science, or, you know, what would a crowd be like at one of these book clubs?
It's a mixture, as you might expect. It's people from Salesforce. It's people from Lilly. It's doctors. It's academics. But it's also normal, regular, non-science people, people who might come with their friends who read the book, or people who just stumble upon it. And I think that's what makes the discussion really rich, is it's people who can add to this conversation,
right,
but also people who are just there because they're very interested, and this is not part of their day job.
Okay, trick question, and we won't tell anybody I asked this, but what percentage of the people at each event have actually read the science book, and does that really matter?
I don't think it matters. I would say from a purely, this is purely just my gut reaction, I would say about a half or a third of the people have read the book. And I think it's helpful if you read. You can ask better questions. You can come prepared. But it's definitely not necessarily necessary. And you can have a great conversation and get some great takeaways if you haven't read the book.
Well, that's really great. So thanks for stopping by. The Indiana Humanities, always busy connecting Hoosiers to brainy things. Mm-hmm. What else do you guys have coming up in the near future?
In January, we have a great talk with Dr. Jennifer Walthall about big data and opioid use and how they're using big data to conquer the opioid epidemic. So that's in January. Check us out at indianahumanities.org for more information. And the book club website is indianahumanities.org/science-book-club.
Awesome. Kristen, thanks for coming by today.
Thank you.
Contributor Ben Schein with Indiana Humanities Vice President Kristen Foose-Wells. Learn more at indianahumanities.org. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, just around the corner, using Star Trek to promote science, technology, engineering, and math. But first, Eat, Drink, Indie's Jolene Ketzenberger talks with Sherry Duggar about her work with the Indiana Farmers Union and the screening of an upcoming documentary called Farmers for America.
So first, tell me a little bit about Indiana Farmers Union, in case people aren't familiar with that name and that entity. What is it?
Indiana Farmers Union is housed under the National Farmers Union. They are here in Indiana to promote and support family farmers and ranchers to be able to provide education, legislation, and cooperative development for those farmers. So we do everything in terms of giving them workshops, classes on food safety or anything like that that they might need. We also support cooperative development. So if there's a set of farmers that want to work together to build a cooperative, that we will help them do that, and we can find ways to help them do that. We also provide legislative support for them if they need it. If they have issues that they're dealing with on a personal level, we can take that to the state level. We can also take that to the federal level with the National Farmers Union.
Now, how long has the organization been in Indiana?
There's a long history there. It was sort of first established at the beginning of the 1900s, but officially we say it was established in 1955.
Now, are there members in, is it a county membership? Is it statewide?
A statewide membership. Whenever you join the Indiana Farmers Union, you're automatically a member of the National Farmers Union as well. So there are counties that you can actually develop chapters if you wanted to under the Indiana Farmers Union. So if you had a group in your county that you wanted to band together and do your own thing underneath the umbrella, then you could do that as well.
Now, you have a conference coming up here
in
Indiana?
Yeah. Every year they have an annual convention or conference that they hold. This is a free event for their members, as well as anyone who's interested in becoming a member, wants to know more about the Indiana Farmers Union. It starts actually on November 17th. We have a farm tour at Boyer Farms in Converse, Indiana. I don't know if you're familiar with Healthy Hoosier Oil. They're a sixth-generation farm, and they actually sort of diversify their offerings and have branched out into sunflowers and canola oil.
Right.
And so we're going to go tour that farm on November 17th. And then on November 18th, we have our actual convention where we're going to have speakers and a film screening, et cetera.
Now, tell me about the film a little bit, about the documentary.
It's called Farmers for America, and it just actually had its national debut here in Indianapolis during the FFA convention. And it is Graham Merriweather is the director and the editor of that film, and he also produced some years back a film called American Meat. But he basically went around the country, spent years, I believe, traveling the country and talking to farmers, beginning farmers, established farmers, all types of family farmers who were doing all kinds of different farms, you know, from commodity farming, corn and soybeans, to doing small diversified urban farms. So he talked to them about, you know, their issues, what they're dealing with, what access to land, to food, to to credit, everything, every problem that they could possibly have as new and beginning farmers and as established farmers.
And so that's what the film explores, is these issues facing family farmers?
Yes, family farmers.
Now, does it call for, you know, is there a call to action? Is there something that, that the film is, you know, promoting that, that should be done?
Well, I think the film explores the idea that there are three or four major companies that produce most of the meat that we consume in the world. And I think that conglomeration of, you know, power is not good for our family farmers. They don't have a lot of voice in, at a legislative level. They don't have a lot of voice, you know, in terms of being able to get fair prices for their food and their commodities and being able to be, really speak up for themselves and be heard. And so I think that's kind of an underlying, you know, there's a problem here. Our food system is broken, and we have to find ways to support our family farmers.
You can hear Jolene Ketzenberger's Eat, Drink, Indy Saturday mornings at 11 on WFYI HD2, The Point. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and coming up, Arts at All Saints kicks off its music season. But right now, Starbase Indy started as a Star Trek fan convention, and this year's Thanksgiving weekend will offer up actors who've been in the films and TV series, along with experts on everything from Star Trek costumes to the Klingon language. But this year, the organization is adding in a new purpose, and WFYI's Jill Dittmeyer got the scoop.
Lisa Meese is one of the organizers of the group, and when they first created the group, they were just all about celebrating all things Star Trek. But this year, they have decided to take on a new mission, and they're going to include more humanitarian and STEM-related activities.
So we're kind of a hybrid event. We're still bringing in actors like traditional Star Trek conventions do. We have Denise Crosby, who played Tasha Yar. We have Robert O'Reilly, who played Gowron, one of the Klingons in The Next Generation and Deep Space Nine. But we also have a bunch of science educators coming in. We have Kyle Hill, who is the science educator for The Nerdist, and he has a podcast, a YouTube channel called Because Science, and he uses pop culture to teach real science. We have astronaut Dr. David Wolf coming in to talk about his experiences being actually in space. And we've got the linguist who invented the Klingon language and the other Star Trek languages, talking about that process and linguistics and the brain. We've got a geneticist coming in. So we've got a bunch of really cool educators coming in. And science activities, like program a robot and see if it does what you think you just programmed it to do. And extract DNA from some fruit and see that process and see how it looks. And learn to brew beer or distill spirits, or learn how solar panels work. So we have a lot more science this year than we have traditionally.
And why the STEM outreach program? Why is that important for your mission now?
If we go back to Roddenberry's original Star Trek vision, it was that we make the future better through science. So getting people interested and inspired by science is an important part of what Star Trek has always been about. And a lot of science fiction historically has predicted the future, right? That technology that was on Star Trek back in the 60s and in old science fiction is stuff we take for granted today. And that's because science fiction writers and creators have always been interested in what is the state of the science right now, and where does that mean we're likely to be in 100 years? So there's always been that connection. And so we're just trying to make that explicit.
And why is this important for young people to get involved and learn more about science, not to be afraid of science?
Well, I think you just said it. We want young people not to be afraid of science. It's how we know about the world that we live in. And it is how we figure out solutions to the problems that are facing us.
What is it about science that interests you so much?
For me, science and science fiction is about possibilities. It's about what, first, just the nuts and bolts of how does this world and the universe work? It's fascinating when you start to look at how things come together and whether it is why do trees change their leaves in the fall, which we're seeing a lot of right now, or how do you actually put people into space? What would another planet be like? You know, what do the rings of Saturn actually look like? It's all just really fascinating. And science fiction for me is about humans playing with ideas. How would the universe be different if? And that is everything from if we were living on another planet to a lot of cultural issues have historically been explored through science fiction as well. And it gives us a container to play with that in a way that feels a little safer and allows us to be a little bit more experimental.
And because they are incorporating a lot more of those educational activities, they're hoping they're going to get a lot more families this year, too, Sharon. In the past, there have been some families, but it's just mainly been a lot of just Star Trek aficionados. So they're not waving them away, but they're saying, you know, we've got more stuff for kids and adults to learn a little bit more and appreciate science in a whole new way.
Yeah, don't tell the kids that there's education involved, though.
They'll still be able to learn the Klingon, so they'll be happy.
Do you have any words of Klingon?
No, I don't.
And I'm a big Bang Theory fan. Mm. You would think I would have picked some up along
Did
the years.
Did they speak Klingon on that show?
Occasionally, yeah.
Okay. Well, there you go. Tune in next time, folks.
That's
when
right.
Sharon attends the Starbase Indie convention and comes back with Klingon.
You know, I am letting down everyone out there who thinks that public radio people are just nerds with capital N's. Well, we'll have to get back with them on that. Hey, you know what? There are other arts things going on, whether or not you speak Klingon, and we'll tell you about some on our calendar we call
What'll We Do?
The last art walk in Brown County, last art walk of the season, is this very Saturday from 4 to 8. So you're up early listening to us, right? Grab a brochure at the Visitor Center. It's a free self-guided tour. There are 15 downtown galleries featuring original, local, and regional fine arts and crafts. Lots of galleries offer music and light refreshments. And look for the art walk signs to find participating galleries. And also, don't forget, we're kind of at peak leaf season right now. So go to Brown County and make sure to keep your eyes open outside the galleries as well.
I made a bunch of rounds during First Friday for November and some exhibits that are going to be up through the end of the month that you should try to see if you have the time. Over at the Circle City Industrial Complex, it's the last show by the members of IDOTA. Remember, they are dissolving that group, but they have a great show in the Schwitzer Gallery in the upstairs, a big gallery on the second floor. At New Day Craft in Fountain Square, Justin Vining and Johnny McKee use Legos, beans, and embroidery, yes, to give everyone a brand new, fresh look at art. It's if you want to smile, go see this show at New Day Craft. And right down the street in Garfield Park at Sanders Studio, Benny Sanders. Boy, I'll tell you, every time that man picks up a brush or a piece of charcoal, as he's doing this time, and creates something, it just gets better and better. Stop in and see the latest works in his studio as well. And if you happen to be over at the Jewish Community Center, Cindy Wingo, it's been a long time since she's shown her art, and she has just some of her beautiful, uplifting, sign of the times. We need this kind of art to put a smile on our face on the lobby walls right now at the JCC.
The new exhibit at the Indianapolis Museum of Art at Newfields is called Portraits of Our City. You heard all about it with a recent interview that our colleague Melissa Davis did after a really dazzling opening. Don't forget, it's not just about the opening. It is up actually through the end of July of this coming year, but don't wait that long. Go on over right now and see 450 beautiful black and white photographs depicting the residents of our Circle City. And make sure you perk your ears up because there's an audio installation as well.
And if we haven't given you enough suggestions, you can find more where? At the indiearts.org/guide link. That's on the Arts Council of Indianapolis's website. And of course, we'll be back again next week with Klingon and more things to do on the calendar that we call
What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and central Indiana. Your host is Sharon Gamble. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202, or you can email us at aotm@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on wfyi.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble. Coming up, dancing lights and s'mores made for you by Girl Scouts. But first, All Saints Episcopal Church has been a spiritual and arts anchor in the Old North Side for decades. Their Arts at All Saints season begins this week, and I invited their committee chair, Norman Brandenstein, to give us a little sneak preview.
You have, as do most Episcopalian churches, this is one of the great things about going to an Episcopalian church, very cognizant of the arts.
Yes.
And especially of music.
Yes.
The Arts at All Saints Committee has been going on for a number of years.
Yes.
How long have you been involved?
I joined the committee 2 years ago and then was asked to take leadership this coming into this season. So I was involved on the committee helping last year's season. Mm-hmm. And then they asked me, the person who was chairing it before had stepped in, somebody had to leave, and mm-hmm. so she was ready to pass it along. And it's been really exciting to hearken back to my own days in the arts. It's really fun.
Yeah. So one of the things I like about All Saints is that it seems to regularly, you seem to regularly throw open your doors and say to the community, come on we don't care what your denomination is. We want you to come in and see this fabulous building. You have an amazing organ.
Yes. Goulding and Wood. Mr. Goulding is a member of the congregation.
Uh-huh.
It is a compilation of lots of variable pieces over the years that they put together to create this phenomenal instrument. And yes, above the outside door for many years has been all are welcome, and that speaks to the heritage of inclusivity, even racial. The building was built in 1864, or the church was founded in 1864. It was one of the first to integrate. Homeless shelter was established, GLBT community. So, throw the doors open, both in terms of community-wide, come, but also specific to the arts.
Mm-hmm.
We'll do even song and benediction now. We have the traditional, we're going to be having the lessons and carols leading into
that.
Advent.
Yeah.
Frank Bowles is now our organist choir master as interim. Jeanette Fischel, who was the chair of the organ department at IU School of Music, had served us for 2 years. She had to step back from that leadership. So Frank has stepped in as an interim.
Good catch.
Congratulations. Yeah, thank you. We're very excited about that. So, yes, opening the doors and then all kinds of cultural events, leads to this season as well.
Yeah, and so you're opening with anybody who hasn't had the chance yet to hear Ensemble Voltaire, Indie Baroque,
the old Ensemble Wabash was, yeah.
You're not old enough to remember that, neither am I. But their chamber players quartet will be doing a Telemann in Paris concert.
Yes.
Lovely, elegant music.
Yes. And it was a time when he was in Paris writing in 1738. And these are two quartets that he wrote during that time. And so we'll be getting a quartet size representation from mm-hmm. the Baroque chamber players, who are then part of the larger Indianapolis Baroque Orchestra.
Mm-hmm.
And I had been wanting last year to bring them in. I've known Tom Gerber for many years, and just to round it out, he'll be joined by Leila Bretoft and Martha Perry and Erica Rubis as members of the quartet. I've known Tom, and I knew that the sound in that space would just be wonderful.
Yeah, we should mention that. Your acoustics in that church are magnificent for instruments and voices, by the way.
And it was originally designed to be the cathedral for the Diocese of Indianapolis, the Episcopal Diocese. And then over some time, they did not have funding. And Mr. Lilly, I just heard this story today, made a gift, a major endowment to the Episcopal Diocese, with the condition that they would make Christ Church on the circle of the cathedral. So All Saints became then another congregation.
Yeah.
And but the space originally was designed to be like a European cathedral.
Yeah.
Brick, high vaulted ceilings. And the sound is just fabulous there.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And you're going to take advantage of those acoustics with your February organ concert. Tell me a little bit about this organist.
Yes, Jörg Hannes Hahn is making his American debut.
Wow.
At this concert. He is a colleague of Jeanette Fischel, who was with us previously, and so she had arranged. He's from Stuttgart, Germany, and he'll be coming in February on the 11th, and he'll be serving actually twofold that day. He'll be the organist and choir master for the 10 a.m. All Saints regular mass, and then that afternoon at 4 p.m. he'll be doing a concert titled Glory to God Alone, the Chorale as the Heart in Protestant and Catholic Faith.
Hmm.
Not sure yet what the elements of that program will be. We're still corresponding with him. But he's excited about coming, and we're excited about having him, and again, making use of an incredible instrument in that space. So I know it will be a dynamic, dynamic concert.
Norman Brandenstein is chair of arts at All Saints. The music series is free and open to the public. The church is at 16th and Central Avenue, and that Telemann in Paris program is Sunday afternoon, November 12th at 4 o'clock. Learn lots more at allsaintsindy.org. Newfields calls its new winter show a curated outdoor lights experience, but we're betting people will simply call it dazzling. More than 1.2 million holiday lights are being installed in trees, on buildings, and in pathways throughout the Verdant campus. I invited Jonathan Wright, the IMA's Ruth Lilly Deputy Director for Horticulture and Natural Resources, to describe how the idea to light up Newfields campus came about and what kinds of elfin magic are required before the spectacle opens later this month.
All right, I want you to take us behind the scenes. A project this enormous in scope doesn't just happen. There was a lot of research. Who first had the idea of transforming these amazing grounds into winter lights?
Well, you're absolutely right. It takes a lot of research. Our executive director, Charles Venable, and the whole senior team, when I arrived about 18 months ago, and through the interview process, they mentioned that they might want to dabble in doing a light show in the winter. And having grown up near Longwood Gardens outside of Philadelphia, mm-hmm. I knew exactly the sort of show that they were hoping to sort of model this after. Being the institution that we are, we want to do everything on a world-class level. So Charles had done his homework and found two amazing light shows, one in Sweden and one in Denmark, as well as the Atlanta Botanical Garden, Longwood Gardens outside of Philadelphia, the Morton Arboretum in Chicago, and Sheikwood Museum and Garden down in Nashville. Those were the six main places that we used as our inspiration for this show.
Quite different places. I've only been to about half of them, but quite different places.
Very different. And that's what was wonderful for us to see, was how each of these places really did owned who they were and built a show that drew in, you know, hordes of people, you know, happy, smiling people who come back every year, and it becomes a family tradition by being specific to who they are. So, you know, one of the things that we learned from the Morton Arboretum was don't try to recreate what other people are doing. Be true to who you are. And their show, they are the champion of trees, so their show is very much about the trees. And so that was a really important lesson for us. And we have, as everyone who's visited our wonderful garden and campus knows, we have extraordinary 100-year-old mature trees. So that became key to me, that we had to really highlight what makes our garden and our property so special.
Big, tall trees that are hard to get lights up on.
Very difficult. When we started doing this process, I said, why does no one light their trees all the way to the tips here? Why does no one do this? I'm learning why. we have
last
very
words,
talented teams of people helping us. It's very famous last words. To get lights 80 feet up into the branches of trees, it involves arborists who have are skilled at climbing. It involves 110-foot lifts. And
which you have to get in between other things without
damaging the garden, without compacting the soil. So we've learned a whole process of building temporary roads out of large mats so we could drive equipment in.
Wow.
It's quite the production. And if for those listeners who have visited the gardens in the last few weeks, you've seen a lot of it happening quietly and sometimes not so quietly behind the scenes.
Not a bad thing. You make people ask, hey, what's happening here? So they can come back. And you're a gardener and I'm a gardener, so we know that gardens are gorgeous through the winter. Most people think of walking into a garden as a spring, summer, and maybe fall sport. But this is an amazing excuse to get people to come see the grounds at a time of year when people aren't necessarily focusing on outdoor adventure.
That's very true. I think one of our hopes with this is to get everyone to embrace winter and really look at the garden in big pun, in a new light.
You're allowed.
And so even our gardeners who have, you know, some of our staff have been with the museum for 25 years, and even they have been saying how impressed they are that when you see a tree, you know, an 80-foot American beech tree that's wrapped within an inch of its life to the very tips of the branches with 50,000 little LED lights, it just brings the tree to life in a new way. And you see it as a sculpture. You see the structure of the tree. You see how magnificent they are. And I really hope people see that when they come and sort of find the magic of the garden in a new light.
So I know you have a lot of different garden rooms defined by the more than 1 million lights of winter lights. I understand that there was one design element, harkening back to the advice you garnered to make it your own. Don't try to recreate what somebody else is doing. Can we talk about the gates that were a jumping off point?
Absolutely. So we worked with a nationally known designer who's built these shows for other gardens because we wanted someone who had some experience understanding how traffic flows and how you pace the show. Because we really have curated this the way we do any show, that we do any exhibition. And when Trey Fromey, our designer, came on site, he was blown away by just how elegant and graceful the historic core of our garden is. And one of the things that really stood out to him and we thought was a great inspiration were the beautiful gates on the original Woodstock Bridge. So that original bridge that linked the land and property to the village of Woodstock, and the land and property then became the Lilly Estate. Those gates are beautiful, sort of scrolled ironwork. And then when you get to the front door of the Lilly House, there are beautiful scrollwork iron gates on the front door of the house as well. And so our designer thought, wouldn't it be wonderful to bring those scrolled patterns to life, sort of slightly abstracted, but they recreate themselves. They sort of reappear throughout the show. When you arrive at the entrance to Newfields through the 38th Street gate, there'll be these sort of curls of ironwork that we've created that are going to be sparkling in little white lights. Ooh. That sort of they give the effect of winter, like the winter wind rolling across the driveway. But they're really abstractions of those big curls off of the gate. And then when you come in to the first floor of the museum, you'll see those curls projected onto the floor to help light your way out to the garden. And then they really come to life in scrollwork snowflakes that we've created that will float magically above the bridge and illuminate it in little white and red and yellow and orange lights. And then they're repeated in a big way when you get out to the Lilly House.
I don't want you to give all the secrets away. Will there be a particular path that people should take, or are you anticipating people will follow a certain path and then maybe go back to their favorite part?
That's a great question. We are anticipating that folks will follow a sort of prescribed path, but we're not going to put out big signs that tell you have to go
turn
a certain
here.
Way. We hope that we've designed the show in such a way that you follow the light.
Yeah.
And it's going to be multi-sensory as well. So it's not just light. We're going to use sound and music to help draw you through at certain points in the show. There will be large bowls of fire so that the kids can make s'mores and you can warm up if it's a particularly cold night.
And
so
we're
using all
of that. Beverages available.
Definitely
speaking
beverages.
Of multi-sensory. And
definitely
adult beverages available if you're old enough.
The hot cocoa for the kids, and I've dubbed it cocoa with a wink for the adults in the group if you'd like, but also beer and wine and a wonderful mulled cider as well. So the idea is that you can grab your favorite beverage, chilled or warm, and stroll among the lights with your family. And I hope people love it as much as I do. I'm a little close to it at the moment. So.
You're not neutral. I know that you've had many, many, many volunteer hours on the front end of this, on the installation end. I'm curious, will you need equal volunteer hours at the end of the show to take it down?
We definitely will need volunteer help to help wrap up the show. We probably won't be asking our volunteers to climb trees in February and January with the weather. But yes, we've been so grateful, and I can't thank our incredible team of volunteers enough.
Jonathan Wright is Newfield's Ruth Lilly Deputy Director for Horticulture and Natural Resources. Winter Lights opens to Newfield's members on November 17th and 18th, and then to the public through January 7th. There are two shows nightly, except for Mondays. The shows are at 5 and 7, and food and beverage are available for purchase. You can pursue all of the other holiday traditions there, too, including touring the lavishly decorated Lily House, checking out Carl Unach's whimsical 50-foot Christmas tree called Playtime in Indy, and much more. And you can learn more and get tickets at discovernewfields.org. And if that need for volunteers caught your attention, email volunteer@imamuseum.org. Every week, a Cultural Manifesto's Kyle Long talks five songs with someone from our community. Here's this week's journey.
I'm Kyle Long from Cultural Manifesto. I'm here today with Felix Medina of Vedia Global. Felix, thank you for being here.
Hey, thank you for having me, Kyle.
And tell us a little bit about this company you've started, Vedia Global.
Yeah, this company started with the idea of focusing on one thing about everything else, which is on the culture. So what I do with clients is I sit down and I help my clients to figure out what it is that they want to say in the language that they want to speak. So for example, if you talk about a brewery, there is a famous local brewery that you might know, Sun King. They reached out and they say, well, we want to sell our beer, but we want to sell our beer to the Spanish speakers. So how do I do that? So then someone from my team or myself, we sit down with a client, in this case, say, this brewery, and then we tell them, well, this is how we would market to, say, the Hispanic population. This is how we would sell your product. And that's what I do basically with my clients. I train them in cultures so they can understand their international markets better.
And Felix, you have five songs to share with us today. Mm-hmm. What is your first selection?
My first selection is a song that every time I play it, I have to move. It's called Kingston Town. The name of the guy is Alba Rose. This is really cool because this guy is from Italy.
Right, yeah.
This guy is from Italy, and he liked reggae so much and Jamaican culture so much that he actually moved to Jamaica, but people didn't like him, so people didn't accept him. And there is a slang for kind of like saying jerk. They say borose. So they started calling him borose. And then he said, you know what? I'm going to transform that negativity that these guys are putting on me, and I'm going to transform it into light. So then he transformed into Alba Rose. And he's an awesome musician. Some man have no manners, still a try fi beg a thing. If you no drop no green, a straight up this thing ting. On a bun traffic, it's a slow rhythm. JCF a move rough, them bust the M16.
And what's your second song for us, Felix?
The second song is very special to me. It's in Arabic. It's I'm going to try my best because I do not speak Arabic. And it's Beta Amr. And this song is by, again, it's Arabic, Kebes Dale. And these guys are just mind-blowing. These guys are a band of Syrian refugees. And they I believe they moved to Lebanon or a country near in the area to play their music, and now they're pretty successful, but they're not like mainstream. Number three is my boy, Xavier Rudd. Xavier Rudd is an awesome activist, surfer, spiritual guru, and amazing musician. Xavier Rudd is from Australia, and his song is The Lioness Eye. And he plays with, obviously, with authentic Australian instruments, as you might know, the didgeridoo.
Number four.
Number four is called the Spring Song, and it's by a Ukrainian band called Daka Braka. And they're Ukrainian. My great-grandmother migrated from Kiev, Ukraine, to Mexico, and I just realized that last year. So this is something that it has touched me, and then I just connected the dots, and I said, awesome, Daka Braka.
And you have one final song for us, Felix.
My final song, I mean, obviously, I was born and raised in Mexico, so I can't, yeah. Like we say in Mexico, no puedo negar la cruz de mi parroquia. It's like, can't deny who I am. So I chose Las Flores. It's a song by Café Tacuba.
And Felix, tell folks where they can find more information about Veria Global online.
Yeah, well, the easiest and the best way to connect with our company, it will be go online, and it's just very simple, straightforward, veriaglobalservices.com. Veria is with V as in Victor, E-D-I-A, and then Global Services.
veriaglobalservices.com. Thank you so much for these five great songs, Felix. Appreciate it.
Oh, my pleasure. I enjoy sharing.
Hear Kyle's A Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio Wednesday nights at 8 or Saturday nights at 10. Thanks for listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and today's contributors included Jill Dittmeyer and Ben Schein. Hear The Art of the Matter Saturday mornings at 7 or join us Thursday nights at 8. And remember, you can always listen to and share our podcast at WFYI.org. Next week, we're thankful for the chance to listen to some of our favorite interviews again. And, of course, we'll have that arts calendar we call What'll We Do? All of that and so much more on The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Central Indiana and Indianapolis. The Art of the Matter is executive producer Roxana Caldwell, contributor Jill Dittmeyer, and host Sharon Gamble. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.